Atheist Nomads, episode 107, interview with Dr. Zachary Moore, part 2.
Atheist Nomads is proudly brought to you by Archway Hosting. Check out their low-price, full-featured hosting solutions at archwayhosting.com. That's A-R-C-H-W-A-Y hosting.com.
Hey, we're also brought to you by listeners just like you. Find out how you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. That's patreon.com/atheistnomads.
As a concerned parent of the free thought community, I want to advise Atheist Nomad listeners that this is an adult show. There will be things discussed, talked about, topics that may be inappropriate for children under the age of 25, 40. 26, 27, yeah. 40.
We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. All right, so you've covered a bit about what it's like to be, you know, active in the atheist community in Texas. And I know, you know, metropolitan areas are always different than, you know, the rural areas.
Sure.
But what would be the overall feel in Texas as an atheist?
So I've said this many times, Texas is a great place to be an atheist right now. So not only do we have, like in Dallas Fort Worth, as you said, you know, it's a metropolitan area, but there is something about Texas. And I think it's because the state itself has this sort of very conservative culture that's sort of baked in very deeply. But at the same time, you have all these people coming into the state from out of it, mostly from the north or the east, like myself. I'm originally from Ohio, and I'm from Cincinnati, which is a fairly conservative part of Ohio. But even in Cincinnati, you do not discuss religion. You don't talk about what church you go to with anybody but, you know, close family or friends. But in Texas, that's a big part of your life. That's a big part of your social fabric and what you share with people. And when you meet a neighbor, you know, they want to know what church you go to and all this stuff. And so, and there's billboards all over the place, you know, religious billboards and the massive churches. I mean, churches that are, you know, really honestly just temples to the egos of the pastors that that work at them. But you know, they're huge and they dominate the landscape and you can't avoid it. And so what happens is you have people kind of like me who come into this environment and they're confronted by religion everywhere. And the people that grew up here, you know, they're like fish in water. They don't notice it because they grew up with it. Like, well, of course there's a church on every corner. That's just the way it is. But for people that come from out of the state, it's very sort of off-putting. And we, as a result of that, we try to look for each other, and we're much more motivated to do that, I think, than people who are like way out in other areas in, you know, maybe like the Northeast and Boston or New York City. They're not quite as motivated to find other people who are ideologically like them because that's fairly easy to find. But in Texas, that's a bit of a different story. And so when the new atheist phenomenon started, right? So you had these books by Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins. These, the books themselves were not, I mean, I think they're reasonably good books. I think Harris's book, especially his second book, Letter to a Christian Nation, was fantastic. And the other ones are fun too. But the big impact was not what they said, but the fact that they were popular. The big impact is that I walked into a Barnes & Noble in Dallas, Texas, and I saw God Is Not Great on the front shelf, on the featured shelf, as you walk in the store, you know, copy after copy after copy of this book, you know, staring me in the face as I walked into Barnes & Noble in Red State, Texas. And I thought to myself, this is different. This is, there's something going on here. And I said, who is buying all these books in Texas? Who, I mean, I know I have a copy, but who else is reading these? And so that's what really motivated us because we knew there were other all these other people in our neighborhoods reading these books. There had to be. So where were we? And we looked on Facebook, we looked on Meetup and other websites to try to find each other. We found each other. We started groups like the Fellowship of Free Thought and all these other groups that exist now in Dallas-Fort Worth. When I first got active, there were 3.5 groups really. Now there's 20, and there's probably more than 20. There's more that start up kind of every few months or so, and I don't really pay that much attention anymore, but there's at least 20, which is crazy. It is impossible. If you want, at this moment right now, if you want to meet up with an atheist group in Dallas-Fort Worth, you can within about 10 miles from your house, and they're probably having a meeting tonight, in fact.
Wow.
And that's just like what churches provide, right? So that's, you know, just like with churches, like there's probably a church in an easy drive and there's probably one that's doing something tonight, you know, a Bible study or a spaghetti dinner or whatever.
Oh, sure. There's a lot more fellowship with atheists now, but just most of it involves beer.
Well, a lot of it does. A lot of it does. As more and more families get involved, there's, and that's not to say that the beer stuff is going away, but it's, that's just one thing among many that we do. So with the Fellowship of Free Thought, for example, they have lots of social things that they do. They have dinners and bar nights and stuff. But they also do a lot of outreach and family stuff. In fact, they have a charity outreach group just for kids. So they've got one that they do sort of regular stuff. You know, the adults get together and they clean up the highways, or they collect things for different charities that are locally. Or one of the things that we used to do is we used to get together and bake cookies, have like a cookie baking party on a Saturday afternoon. Everybody gets together and they all bake their favorite recipes of cookies, and then we box them up and we take them to the closest fire station or police station.
Oh, badass.
But the kids have their own things that they do, and they accumulate, depending on how many things that they do, how many activities they participate in, they get Sagan stars, and they get to reimburse their Sagan stars for different things, or they get to apply those. So the Fellowship of Free Thought offers camperships for Camp Quest Texas. So you can use your Sagan stars, I believe I'm right on this, you can use your Sagan stars to help boost your chances to get a campership to Camp Quest. So there's real, like, you know, tangible things that you're doing that are, you know, improving your situation, but also improving your community situation. Everybody's working together towards a common goal. And that's exactly the type of stuff that we should be doing. And that's the type of stuff that we are doing more and more of, at least here in Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston as well. So the other, you know, cool thing about Dallas is we've got, or the cool thing about Texas, we've got Dallas-Fort Worth, which is a huge community of atheists, but we've also got Houston, which is even larger, if that's at all possible. And I did some fundraising this year for Camp Quest Texas as well. And I went around to all the different groups and I said, look, we're trying to recruit groups to sponsor camperships this year, you know, and we'd like you to sponsor at least two. You know, what do you say? And it was pretty successful, because it's, you know, Camp Quest is such a great cause. I'm sure you guys are familiar with Camp Quest. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. So all you have to do is say Camp Quest and like, yeah, let's do more of that. So I was going to Houston and Dallas and Fort Worth and Austin. I was getting all these groups to contribute, and the Humanists of Houston donated 6 camperships. And
damn.
Yeah. Holy crap. At the beginning, when I was trying to recruit them, I said, you know, here, I'd like you to do 2. And they're like, 2? I don't know if we could do 2. And I said, just do it. It's just a great cause. And, you know, here's all this information about what it is that we do and all this stuff you can tell your members. And they ended up donating 6, which is fantastic.
Just out of curiosity, how many kids do you get down in your Camp Quest?
So we have, we're at over 100 now.
Nice.
It's actually kind of a problem.
And how many are getting sponsored?
Yeah. At least, so our goal is to have 10% of them receiving camperships, because, you know, there are a lot of kids that come from economically disenfranchised homes and have their families have trouble.
Yeah.
The camp. So we try to reserve spots for about 10% to get aid.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really important to us. And I think we actually did better than that this year. I think we got close to 15%. So that's really good. The problem, though, is not the kids. The problem is the space. We don't have enough space. We actually have a waiting list that is almost as long as our registration list at this point. And we've had that issue for the past couple of years. Yeah. There are so many families that want to get their kids involved in Camp Quest. It's unbelievable. And a lot of these families are not in the big metropolitan areas like Dallas Fort Worth. A lot of them are in, you know, these, you know, out of the way places, military areas like Killeen, you know, and there are just so many kids. It's crazy. It really sucks to have to turn them away. But unfortunately, we're sort of limited by the number of volunteers that we have. So we, you know, the whole thing is nonprofit. It works all on a volunteer basis at the moment. And we can only provide camp for as many kids as we can recruit volunteers to, you know, so we'd have to have, you know, two counselors, usually three per cabin, and all these other volunteers to do all the things that happen at camp, which is actually this coming weekend, believe it or not. Hmm. So,
oh, sweet.
Sounds like it's time to split.
Yeah. Well, that's something that we've been thinking about really hard. It's a problem, though, because what we're looking for is a camp that sort of meets all of our needs, you know, provides nice cabins, air conditioned cabins, has, you know, a pond or a lake or a pool optimally, and all these other activities for us to do. But it also has to be available. We have a YMCA camp near San Antonio that we're using right now, and they have their own programming through the end of July. And then after July, they sort of shut down and they make their camp available to rent. The other YMCA camps, I think, do pretty much the same thing. We've used a different YMCA camp near Possum Kingdom Lake, which is a little bit closer to Dallas. And we moved to the south because people were complaining that, hey, you guys have it way up north all the time. You should have it down further south. But really what we need is one close to every area. We need one outside of Dallas. We need one outside of Houston. We need one outside of San Antonio. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe one outside of Austin as well. It's a massive job, and we're to the point now where it's almost more than volunteers should be asked to do. We're to the point now where it's in order for this to proceed, we have to make some transition somehow into having a paid staff that does this all the time, because it's just so much. When we started, it was just, I think, like a dozen volunteers, and we had 30 kids that first year, and we just did basically like a weekend camp. But it was tons of fun, and everybody was super excited. And then they wanted to do another one. They said, let's do the full week-long, you know, sleepaway camp. And they just never looked back. And every year, the number of kids increases by at least 10 or 20.
Wow. Just like Texas, it needs to be split into at least three.
Oh, yeah.
I know that up here at Camp Quest Northwest, they actually get they get space from a religious camp of some sort. That usually has, you know, religious Bible camp, and they just take that space over for a week.
Yeah. We actually, so the YMCA is technically religious. They do have like some Bible verses up and some religious songs up in the mess hall. But they're not too terribly religious, and they know exactly who we are. They don't care one whit, which is fantastic. We did one year, we used a camp that was run by the Episcopal Church. And the Episcopal, you would think, like, you know, totally chill and laid back and progressive and everything. But man, they had crosses and crucifixes and all kinds of religious stuff all over every inch of that camp. And they were great to work with, nice people. But the feeling that a lot of people had as they were coming away from that year of camp, they're like, you know, it's not exactly an atheist camp, but we need to at least be comfortable. And when I'm staring at a crucifix every day in my cabin, you know, I'm not exactly comfortable with that. So it depends on the camp, I'm sure. And in Texas, it's hard to find non-religious camps, especially the ones that meet our needs. So it's kind of slow going. But ultimately, that's definitely the vision I have, is a camp outside every major metropolitan area. And I know that, and that's basically the vision that that Camp Quest National has as well. They're run out of Columbus, Ohio, and they've done a fantastic job so far.
Awesome.
Wait, isn't the BSA out of Columbus, Ohio? I swear.
I don't know about that. I know they have some national office here in Dallas Fort Worth. It's actually in Irving, just outside the airport. I don't know if that's their national office or if that's just something that they have there.
Wesley, were you meaning the SSA?
Oh, no, honestly, I thought it was the BSA, Boy Scouts.
Oh. SSA is based in Columbus for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Boy Scouts. I want to.
I could have just totally. Nope. Oh, headquarters, Irving, Texas, for the Boy Scouts.
There you go, Irving, Texas.
Wow.
Thank you, Google.
We love hearing from our listeners. You can email us at contact@atheistnomads.com, tweet us @atheistnomads, send us a message on our Facebook page at facebook.com/atheistnomads, or better yet, call us and leave us a message at 541-203-0666. We might even play it on the show. You can also help us out by leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast directory of choice. All right, so let's see. We've covered your podcasts, your local stuff, a bit on your background. Why don't you talk to us a bit about the national stuff you're involved in?
Sure. And I will get back around to Apologia because I don't think we talked about that. And that is kind of interesting. And it leads a bit into some of the stuff that I'm doing now. But on the national level, I'm involved with Foundation Beyond Belief, and I know you guys are familiar with those. You've had Dale on. You've had, I think, pretty much all the other board members on as well. I've actually been a board member for the foundation since, I think, 2011, and at present, I'm board chair, which really just means that I set the schedule for the meetings that happen, basically. Noelle George is the new executive director. So that was one transition that we had this year. Dale McGowan stepped down. He was doing really fantastic work over at Pathos, managing the Atheist Channel, and handling that and handling the foundation was just a bit too much for him, as it would be for anybody. I mean, Dale is a dare I say, a god among men.
He's a fucking trooper.
He's quite amazing. He's Alex Jules calls him the Mr. Rogers of the atheist community. it's actually a huge compliment if you think about it. But Dale is absolutely the humanist that I aspire to be, in every sense of the word. But so he stepped down and did a tremendous job starting the organization. And Noelle George, who had been with the organization for several years, she took over, was chosen by the board to take over as executive director. And she's doing a phenomenal job getting us in transitioning into some new stuff and really re-looking at all the stuff that it is that we've done so far and saying, okay, what has worked? What has not worked? We're trying to make a more of an effort to be sort of evidence-based. And this was something that was included in our conference that we had last year, where our keynote speaker was talking about how charity can actually be evidence-based. And this is something that really connects with us, I think, as you know, humanist critical thinkers, scientists, you know, like myself. We want to be sort of assured that the work that we're doing and the things that we're supporting out there in the world don't just make us feel good, don't just sound good, but actually are good and are doing good in a real way. So that's going to be one of the things that we're going to be doing. And of course, we also have the, I know you've talked with Rebecca Witzeman. We've got the disaster recovery that's starting this year. And we also have the Humanist Service Corps, which is happening right now in Ghana. Connor Robinson is running that for us. So there's all these fantastic things that we're doing. And I like talking about them. I don't want to make any pretense that I'm taking credit for any of these things that are happening, because this is all not me doing any of this stuff. I'm just sort of on the board. I'm just sort of made aware of what's going on and give advice and provide oversight. There's all these tremendous people that are doing all this work at the foundation, and with Noelle right at the top. So that's one of the really the coolest things about being involved in the atheist community that I can sort of look back on. And you know, Camp Quest is obviously one thing that's really awesome that I'm glad I was able to be part of, and Foundation Beyond Belief as well, because that really gets to the core of what I want to be as a humanist, right? So I started off, as I was saying, sort of leaving Christianity behind, kind of kicking and screaming. I didn't want to give that up. There's a lot of stuff that was a part of that I really liked and really connected with me. And one of the things that I appreciated was this concept of, you know, doing good. The parable of the Good Samaritan really resonates with me. It resonated with me as a Christian. It resonates with me even more as a humanist. And I'm actually quite jealous that it's not a work of humanist literature. It's something from the Christian canon, because that should be a humanist parable. In fact, I would even say that it is a humanist parable. It just happens to be in the Bible.
Samaritan, it sure isn't a Christian parable. I mean,
it's the parable of Jesus, let's say. So they do get the credit for it, I suppose. But the message is humanist, right? So the message mm-hmm. resonates with humanists as well as it does with Christians. And that's exactly what I want to do as a humanist. And that's why I'm pleased to be, you know, serving even as on the board of directors. One of the really great things that I think that the Foundation of Unbelief does, which I don't think many people are aware of or really appreciate, is we do something called Challenge the Gap. And what this is it's started from pretty much the very beginning. We choose all these different charities that are doing fantastic work, and we look for the ones that are doing great work without appealing to religion, right? So we secular charities, because we want to present to atheists and humanists a list of these great charities that are secular, basically. And that's all well and good. And we, of course, we want to support secular charities. But there are also a class of charities that are doing good work, but they are also motivated by religious values, right? That's not to say that they're proselytizing. In fact, what we look for are specifically religiously motivated charities that don't proselytize. So this could be, you know, Quakers or Methodists or Hindus or Sikhs or Muslims or whatever that are organized. They have this group and they do this work because of their religious beliefs, but their work is effectively humanist. And there's nothing about what they do that we would object to as humanists. Like, they're not passing out Qurans, or they're not passing out Bibles or whatever. They're not insisting that people convert to their religion before they receive any services. And that's exactly the type of stuff that we want to encourage. And so we call that Challenge the Gap. And every quarter we put up one Challenge the Gap beneficiary and we say, hey, this is a really good religious charity, and you may want to consider donating to them to try to encourage, sort of communication and dialogue and sort of understanding that, you know, hey, just because somebody's religious doesn't mean they're necessarily an asshole, doesn't mean they're necessarily insistent that you sort of go along with what they believe in order to work with them in some way. Mm-hmm. And that's what inspired me to get Apologia off the ground way back when. So this was in 2006, I think, and I'd just done the Evolution 101 thing, and I think I was doing maybe a few more before I knew I had to stop. But I thought, you know, because I was listening to a lot of podcasts, and there's a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of it was just sort of angry debate, you know, podcasts or radio shows, and none of it felt really productive to me. And I thought, well, look, I've been spending all this time with Kevin Harris and all these people in the Sunday school class. And I know that, you know, these apologists and Christians and whatnot, these are good people. We have stuff that we can learn about. And there are even things on which we would agree. And I said, what if there was a podcast where people just sat down and said, okay, we know that we differ on very crucial things here, but can we discuss the subject and find some area of agreement? And that was the whole idea behind Apologia, basically. And the way it progressed was, it was primarily me and Kevin and then a few other rotating people. And we did just, you know, I think a couple dozen episodes on lots of different topics. And we covered some interesting stuff, some things that maybe people don't find quite so interesting. But that has always kind of been a part of me all throughout this process, is always wanting to find ways to interact with Christians and, you know, find commonalities, find common values, common cause, and especially if any areas that we can find agreement on. So one of the places that you're most likely to find me on a Sunday morning is actually in church, because I still really like church. You know, just because I became an atheist doesn't mean I really stopped liking church. I was kind of disappointed by church. I was disappointed by, the falseness that I found there. But as a humanist, just as I was able to find sort of a renewal of my interest in the Bible, I was able to find a renewal of my interest in the church. And now I love going. I go to all sorts of different types of churches. I go to, you know, Baptist churches, Pentecostal churches, Episcopal churches, Presbyterian. I go to Messianic Jewish churches. I go to synagogues and mosques and temples. And I go to everything, basically, whenever the mood strikes me, which is often. And it really feels to me like an expression kind of my humanism as well, because, you know, I'm in there, and well, part of me is kind of is kind of touristy, I guess. I'm there to sort of see what is going on, because I usually don't revisit churches. Sometimes I do, but usually I go to some place I've never been before. So part of me is I kind of want to see what they're doing here and what they do that is familiar, what they're doing that's not familiar. But another part of me is really appreciating their humanness. And I don't say that to sort of diminish what it is that they're doing. I know that when I come in there and I observe them, I'm participating in what they're doing in a very different way than they are. Uh-huh. They really earnestly believe that what they're doing has some spiritual significance. And it does for me too, but it has a spiritual significance in a naturalistic way. And that's why I sit down with them and I pray with them. I sing their hymns with them. When the Eucharist is passed around, I take the Eucharist with them. And I don't feel disingenuous about that at all. It feels to me like I owe it to them to do that. I owe it to them to participate with them and have this common experience with them. So that's one of the things I do, and I spend a lot of time, a lot of my free time, a lot more than my wife would prefer, I think, all these Christians and trying to, you know, forge relationships with them. And, you know, for the most part, it's been fairly successful. There's a group of apologists, young apologists here locally that I'm, you know, fairly on friendly terms with, and they've had me speak at a couple of their events. And you know, I help them out from time to time when they're looking for atheist speakers as well. So I think it's been a fairly profitable interaction, you know, in all told. And I would encourage any atheist, maybe not any atheist. I think maybe I am a little bit different. But if you're listening to what I'm saying and it kind of resonates with you and you've been thinking about doing this, I would say definitely explore that, because there aren't that many atheists that really do enjoy this type of thing. And I think if you are one of them who's out there, definitely try to explore that and see if it does fit with you.
I'm wondering if you tell the pastors or anybody that you're going to visit them beforehand.
I usually don't, but I usually do. I usually sit up front because people usually don't sit up front. And so there's always an empty seat, and I like sitting and seeing the pastor. So I usually get an opportunity to talk with the pastor afterwards, and I make no bones about who I am or, you know, why I'm there. And usually they're fascinated, and they'll ask me to coffee or to lunch later that week or something like that. And I get to meet with them and learn a little bit more about them. They get to learn a bit more about me. One Southern Baptist pastor, actually, I asked him to lunch after going to church at his church, and we were sitting there over burritos, and he said, you know, I don't think I've ever eaten anything with an atheist. I don't think I've ever had a meal with an atheist before.
Oh, so he has.
I said, you probably have, but now you know you have. And that was a really kind of interesting thing for him, and he would never have thought about that before, I don't think.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of stuff I'm up to.
If you like the show, consider giving us some financial support. To make it really easy with one-time donations, or to support us on a per episode, monthly, or even annual basis using PayPal or Patreon, find out more at atheistnomads.com. Use the links on the right side of the page. $1 an episode is all we ask. Please think of the kittens.
And one of the other projects that I'm working on now is called Gospel of Doubt. And Doubt is, it will be a book. Basically, I'm working on it. Several other people are working on it. We're each contributing a different gospel, so to speak, to the book. And it will be told, different stories of doubt told from different perspectives, basically. So my perspective, there's a couple Christian perspectives of doubt. there's several other people who have come from different backgrounds. One lady who was a former Mennonite, now is an atheist. Someone who was raised Catholic, now is an atheist. And their different experiences of doubt. And what I want to do is, and especially in combining the atheist stories with the Christian stories, I have one lady who's writing a chapter who started as an atheist and then became a Christian. The whole goal with this is to create a series of perspectives, basically. When the readers engage with this, I want them to sort of get to know the different authors as people and appreciate their perspectives, kind of like if you sat down with them and talked with them for an hour, basically. Because that, I think, is the biggest step forward in any sort of person's understanding about the a sort of a foreign or an alien point of view, is trying to wrap your head around, how could a person arrive at this? How could a person get to this point in their lives, and what is going through their heads as they're thinking about this? And that is, I think, has been the one big, not stumbling block exactly, but the one thing that has slowed down progress of humanists and of atheists is that it's so hard for the average person to really wrap your head around that, because God belief is so pervasive and supernatural explanations are so pervasive in our culture that it's hard to wrap your mind around, you know, somebody who doesn't think like that. And it's so funny, because usually when I interact with a Christian for the first time, the questions I get seem to me to be so simplistic and so kind of silly. You know, it's like, well, what do you think happens when you die? You know, and like I've never thought of this, right? But it's clear to me that they ask me this question because they never have. It has never occurred to them to even think about what might happen to you if you died and there was no God and there was no heaven or no hell or whatever. And there are one of the other very frequent questions that I get, usually after a debate, I'm swarmed by the Christians in the audience that didn't get a chance to ask their questions. And over and over and over, I get the question, how do you make any sense of anything? How do you get any meaning in the world? And to me, it's just so funny that would be a question, because as a humanist, as an atheist, there is so much meaning. And in fact, I would say that for me, there's even more meaning, because when I was a Christian, you know, I was sort of going through life, but because of my belief in God, you know, I figured, well, you know, number one, all these theological issues have been figured out, so there's nothing for me to really explore. But number two, you know, I'm a Christian now, so my afterlife is settled. There's really nothing for me to worry about. Whatever happens in my life is no big deal. I don't really need to care about it. I was sort of treading water. I was sort of, you know, holding, you know, steady with whatever trajectory my life was already on, because I figured it didn't matter, because, you know, eventually I would die and that's what really matters. But now that's not in my expectation, whether that is the case or not, it's not in my expectation. Every single moment of life has way more meaning, and infinitely more meaning, because each drop drips, and it's dripping from a cup that will not be refilled. And it's like this Buddhist parable. I mention this every so often when people ask me about meaning. So the parable goes that there's a monk who was running through a forest, and he's being chased by a tiger, and the tiger was right on his heels, right about to grab him. And he bursts out of this forest, and he ends up on the side of a cliff. And he scrambles down the cliff really quickly, but there's nowhere for him to go, and he's hanging onto this branch. And there's nothing else for him to grab onto. And he looks up, and the tiger's head peeks out and it's looking down, and it roars at him, and he knows if he goes up, the tiger gets him, but he's got nowhere to go but down. And he looks on the branch really quickly that he's holding on to, and he sees there's a single strawberry hanging off the branch, and he reaches up with his other hand and plucks it, and he puts it in his mouth, and that strawberry was the best, the sweetest, most tastiest strawberry he'd ever eaten in his entire life. And that's what life is to a humanist. Yes, you've got this tiger chasing you, and yes, you've got this cliff that you're going to run into, but right in that moment, when you taste what life provides you, it is amazing. And I can't even imagine, if I it would actually be kind of a problem for me, I think. I don't know, but I think if I did go back to Christianity for some reason or not, it would be a problem for me to deal with depression, because if I were to go back to the life that I had before after experiencing life as a humanist, I can't imagine keeping up with myself psychologically. It'd be really hard. So I think when I talk to Christians who vocalize those concerns, I think that they probably have thought about that. And one of the things that may be keeping them in Christianity and keeping them from exploring humanism is their inability to sort of visualize what it would be like to make your meaning for yourself as a humanist, to instead of having your meaning handed to me, which I fully agree and I fully admit was really easy. You know, I didn't have to think about it. There was a lot that, you know, it kind of made me maybe lazy, intellectually lazy or theologically lazy, perhaps. But I don't know that I could ever go back to that, or that I would ever want to.
Yeah.
I mean, I might be, you know, if it was demonstrated to be true, maybe I couldn't help but accept the truth of it. But man, would that be depressing.
for me, if it was the God of the Bible, I don't think I could handle worshiping that being.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, and I've mentioned that a few times as well. People ask me, "Well, look, if you could demonstrate to your satisfaction that God existed, you know, what would you do then?" I said, "Well, I mean, I guess I'd have to admit that He exists, but it would be there's a difference between admitting that He exists and worshiping Him, and just because He exists doesn't mean He's worthy of worship, and that's kind of the rub there."
Mm-hmm. Well, from everything I've read, He's kind of a dick. Yeah.
Well, he's, you know, the thing of it is, whenever we talk about sort of theodicy and this kind of stuff, I always go back to Job, right? So all these apologists have all these, you know, explanations and philosophical things. And, you know, they'll say, well, logically, it's entirely possible that God could do all these horrible things or allow all these horrible things to happen. I said, okay, that's fine. But the Bible has already answered all of this for us. The Bible has answered the question of theodicy in the book of Job. Right, that's the whole point of the book of Job, is theodicy.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of Job, right, so Job goes through this whole thing, and all this horrible shit happens to him for no good reason. And we know it's no good reason.
Yeah.
And Job knows it's for no good reason. But all of his friends say, well, no, you've had to have done something. You had to have done something. But he knows that it's not, and we know that he's right. And so this whole time he's complaining because he knows he's been treated unfairly. And he says, look, if Yahweh only showed up, I could ask him questions like a lawyer asks questions of a witness in court. You know, if only he would do that, then I would ask and I would find out. And then lo and behold, Yahweh shows up and presumably to give his answer, right? To say, okay, this is why all this happened. But he doesn't. Right. So if you read it, mm-hmm. What does Yahweh actually say? When Yahweh shows up, he says, who the fuck do you think you are asking me for why I do what I do? I can do whatever I want to do. I am the most powerful, most awesome being in existence, and you are nothing compared to me. So shut the fuck up. That is the last chapter of Job, mm-hmm. paraphrased loosely.
you get the gist of it pretty good.
I don't. So I may have taken a few liberties, but that's the last bit of Job. And that is the answer. That is the biblical answer. The biblical answer to theodicy is shut the fuck up.
Love it.
And so whenever apologists have, they have all these things, and you know, Bill Craig does a bit on this, and Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. Frank Turek makes a lot of hay over this. I just look at them kind of, you know, quizzically, and I say, you do realize this has already been answered by the Bible, and the answer of the Bible is shut the fuck up. Don't question God. The problem is that's a terrible answer. It's a non-answer. Nobody likes that answer, right? So everybody wants to feel like, oh, there's got to be something. There's got to be some great reason why God does all these things. And that's all this philosophical posturing that goes on with apologists. But the Bible just cuts out the middleman and says, you know what? It doesn't even matter. Shut up.
Yeah. Oh, man. Now, on that note, we are out of time.
Perfect.
Yeah. What do you have that you'd like to plug?
Well, I've mentioned Gospel of Doubt, the project I'm working on now. If you want to check up on that, it's gospelofdoubt.net. If you want to read my blog, it's doubtingthomases.net. I blog there with a Christian friend of mine, John Wilson. We don't blog very often, but when we do blog, it's, I think, pretty good. So those are my two current projects in the atheosphere now. And if you want to check out the Fellowship of Freethought in Dallas, that's fofdallas.org. And of course, the Foundation of Belief is foundationbelief.org.
Badass, man.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us. And for our listeners, we will be back next week with news.
Yeah, seriously, Zach, that was awesome, man.
Oh, cool. Glad you liked it.
Yeah. And I'm thinking out of the early list of atheists I wanted to meet. This list was still current at the time of the Reason Rally. And I was very disappointed when you weren't there. I did end up meeting a friend of yours, met Brother Richard. And I think at that point, I had checked off everyone on my list except for you.
Bro. Wow.
Well, no. And check it off.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was funny as it wasn't the, the big name authors. It was the podcasters.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, right? So what would make somebody sit in front of a microphone and just talk out into the world, right? So there's got to be something either weird with them or interesting with them or wrong with them in kind of an interesting way. I think I would agree with that. I think if I had to do the same type of thing, I would want to talk to the podcasters as well. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Dawkins is a cool guy.
Sure.
Sam Harris is, I like his books. I think he's a little too, I don't know.
Yeah, he has issues.
It's a little too something. I think he's great that he's out there for sure.
Dawkins would have been fun. Dawkins would be fun, but Christopher would have been my all time.
Yeah,
I would just love to sit down and shut up.
I got to interview him actually. He was at, it was called the Dallas Christian Book Fair. This was in 2009, I think it was. It was a while ago. It was some Christian publishing consortium. They had this idea. They're going to do this huge conference. / book fair, and they were going to get all the top Christian publishers to be in one place, and it was in Dallas. And I thought, oh, this is perfect. I'm like, this is heaven for me. So I went to the website and I bought the weekend pass, and I'm like, I'm there all weekend just hanging with Christians all weekend. And it was a ghost town. Nobody showed up. Nobody came. And it was actually kind of depressing because they had flown in. The different publishers had flown in some really cool people, like R.C. Sproul was there. J.I. Packer was there. I got my picture taken with him. I talked with him for half an hour. He's one of my dad's favorite theologians. And I'm like, these are like rock stars in the Christian world, and nobody's here to see them.
Talk about
Sproul is one I would like to meet. He helped make me an atheist. Yeah. Oh, really? One of my seminary classes, one of our textbooks, it was Doctrine of Salvation. One of our textbooks was his Faith Alone. And reading through coming from the Adventist background, reading through the Calvinistic viewpoint on faith was totally foreign and totally made sense to me. The faith of assent was what I was lacking. And that book really helped me come to terms with it.
Wow.
Not what he was going for, but... Yeah.
I can imagine. But they were thinking, of course, that it's Dallas, and Dallas is like the center of, you know, huge mega churches, and there's all these Christians in Texas. But none of them came. So it was me. I was the one that came. And they had invited Hitchens to come because he had just done a documentary with Doug Wilson called Collision.
Yep.
And he was there promoting Collision. And they were going to screen it on Friday night. And then on Saturday, they were going to have him do a four-way debate. It was going to be him versus Lee Strobel, Bill Craig, and two other apologists, basically, like four on one.
Oh, wow.
And Doug Wilson was there. And I can't remember who the other person was, but it was him and four apologists. And so there was tons of atheists that came on Saturday for that, for the debate. But nobody else came for anything else. And I had contacted the organizers, and I said, well, hey, look, I've got this podcast I do. It's called Apologia. We do, you know, faith versus reason stuff. I know that you're having this debate. We would love to come and set up our podcast equipment in the back and just sort of talk about the debate before it happens, listen to it, and then talk about it after it happens. What do you think? Would that be all right? And they were either totally unprepared or just didn't care. The lady, yeah, whatever. You know, you show up, whatever, you do whatever you want. So I showed up with all my stuff. And I tried to check in, but there was really nobody to check in with. And I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to do this. So I just grabbed some tables and some chairs, and I set up this studio in the back of the debate room. And I set up all my equipment, got everything plugged in, got all the mics up. Kevin came over. He brought some stuff, and it was just the two of us together. And we were talking before the debate happened, and then we were planning to talk afterwards. And then Kevin said, hey, I could probably get Bill Craig to come over. And so I was like, oh, yeah, that might be cool. And then before he was able to do that, though, Hitchens was on his way out, and he saw the setup in the back, and he assumed that there was a – I think he must have assumed that there was a interview set up for him. So he just came right over and sat down. He said, all right, what are we talking about? And we just started talking with him for about 20 minutes. He's like, all right, you have a sheet? I'm like, yeah, okay, thank you. And he took off. And Bill Craig came over and talked a little bit. I think they were also scheduled to do a debate, I think like a month later over in Biola, I want to say, in Los Angeles. But that was really cool getting to see him there. And I also got to see him in Houston right before he passed. Like I said, he was there at the convention. And oh, my God, it was tremendous. Dawkins gave him the Dawkins Award. And he was getting treatment at MD Anderson, which is why he was there in the first place. And he was having a good day that day. They didn't know. The organizers didn't know if he was going to be able to make it. But he was having a good day that day. He felt well. And he came. And he was hoarse. And they'd only asked him to speak for like 15 minutes, but he ended up speaking for like a fucking hour. Mm. I think he knew that this was probably going to be his last public thing, really, because he just kept going. He was like, does anybody have any questions? Because he felt good. You know, he come when he wanted to milk it still. And then he was finally tired and got up, and Dawkins gave him this big bear hug, which was really fantastic. Dawkins is a piece of work too. You know, he's kind of a weird guy. He's exactly what you would expect an Oxford professor to be, basically.
I've met him twice. He's a really nice guy, though.
He is nice, but he's exactly what you would expect an Oxford professor to be, I think.
Sure.
But he, in that moment, man, he grabbed him, and I'm like, these are just two guys saying goodbye. That's tremendous. And then that was it. And then I think 2 weeks later, he was gone.
Side note, Collision, Douglas Wilson was completely ineffectual.
Yeah, and the filmmakers, I thought, did kind of a sloppy job. I think what they were trying to make a debate seem kind of exciting, so they kept shaking the camera back and forth.
It really wasn't.
But it just made me kind of nauseous.
Yeah, it was like some high school editing bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the debate was nothing. Doug got his ass handed to him.
Well, and here's the thing: the disconnect is that from Doug's point of view, he didn't have his ass handed to him, and
that's what they always think.
He could only say the things that he said, and that's the problem. And that's one of the reasons why I was so frustrated with the dialogue, and one of the reasons why I did Apologia is because I kept listening to stuff like this, where I'm like, these people are just, they're talking in completely different languages. They're never gonna connect on anything. I don't know.
All right. Well, it's been a real pleasure. I need to go mow the lawn, unfortunately.
you have fun with that, and there's a decent chance some of this extra stuff after the outro might be added there too.
All righty, well, thank you very much, and have yourself a good evening.
All right, you too, Dustin.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Right, thanks, guys. Bye.
Yep. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com. Contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.